Welcome back to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox. I'm Cindy Sheehan. You're listening to me on CindySheehanSoapbox.com. First of all, I took a couple weeks off from recording a new soapbox. As most of you know who are listening, I've had a lot of trouble with the Federal Elections Commission. They've been levying fines and requiring me to pay back money. And it's just been a nightmare. It's been a nightmare of the robber class oppressing people who actually stand up against the system, not just half the system, the Republicans or the Democrats, but the entire system. As you all know, I ran against Nancy Pelosi in 2008. That was stressful. But the aftermath of the campaign has been even more stressful, trying to pay off the debts, trying to pay off the fines, thousands and thousands of dollars of fines. And I just want to thank you from the bottom of my heart for helping me do that, to do this, to pay off the fines. In the last 2 months, with your help, I've been able to pay off at least $45,000 worth of debt and fine, and or get it reduced through volunteer action and things like that. So thank you again, Cindy Sheehan for Congress.org. If you would like to donate, we still have a few thousand dollars left that we have to pay off. And this was a people's campaign, and it's a grassroots effort, and we're all in it together. And I just really have been overwhelmed with gratitude by your response. Another reason that I have not been on the air is that my surviving son, Andrew, got a mystery illness, and he was in the hospital for 10 days. I spent almost every minute with him that I could, and he was in intensive care for 4 days, very, very sick. We were very scared. I kept on telling the doctors, I've already had one son die. I'm not about to lose this one. And even though we don't know ultimately what is causing his illness, we ruled out the things that really scared us, like hepatitis and cancer, lymphoma and things like that. But we still don't know what's wrong with Andy, but I'm happy to report that he's out of the hospital. He's at home. He's improving incrementally. You know, every day he gets a little bit better. It hasn't been a really quick recovery, but he is getting better. And I asked you, all my listeners and my supporters, to send Andy cards in the hospital, and he got dozens of cards, and he was very overwhelmed at the kindness of people and their response. And we, my family, I and my son Andy and his fiance Jade, really want to thank you all for your warm wishes, your cards, your prayers, your emails, and your concern really about Andy and about our family. So thank you. And here we are again, Cindy Sheehan Soapbox. I'm glad to be back. I'm glad to report that the problems that have stopped me from being here are being resolved, even though seems like something new happens every day. But today we have a great show. We're going to be talking to investigative journalist Russ Baker about his book, Family of Secrets: The Bush Dynasty, the Powerful Forces That Put It in the White House, and What Their Influence Means for America. When we come back from the short break, we'll be talking to Russ.
Hi, my name is Pam. I live in the Tenderloin District of San Francisco, and I have been a supporter of Cindy's since she announced she was going to run for Congress against Congresswoman Nancy Pelosi. I worked tirelessly on her campaign because I believe in Cindy, and I believe in the cause of peace and justice that she stands for. If you're listening to this show, then more than likely you support Cindy too. Please consider making a donation to keep Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox airing on the web. It is important for me to be able to continue to hear the truth. In a world where truth and courage are in such short supply, Cindy fills that void. Please go to www.cindysheehansoapbox.com and click on the donate link. That's www.cindysheehansoapbox.com.
Welcome back to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox. I'm your host, Cindy Sheehan. As I promised before the break, we'll be chatting with Russ Baker. Russ is an award-winning investigative reporter and founder of WhoWhatWhy.com. He has written for The New Yorker, Vanity Fair, The Nation, The New York Times, The Washington Post, The Village Voice, and Esquire. Today we'll be chatting with Russ about his most recent book, Family of Secrets. Welcome to Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox, Russ. It's great to have you on my show.
Thank you very much, Cindy. Glad to be here.
Well, like I told our listeners, you wrote a book called Family of Secrets, The Bush Dynasty, The Powerful Forces That Put It in the White House, and What Their Influence Means for America. That's quite a mouthful of a subtitle for the book. And what inspired you to write it? And in a nutshell, what is it about?
Back in 2003, I'd been asked to go to the former Yugoslavia and train journalists there in how investigative reporting can create a more vibrant democracy. They were in those emerging democracies of Serbia and Bosnia, and stayed on through 2003, 2004. And while I was there, we had the run-up to the Iraq War and then the invasion, and I was writing some pieces back then for American publications expressing doubts about the basis under which they were going to war and the reasons they were giving. But people there said to me, well, you know, you're here, but telling us how to investigate our government, but what about your own government? And I really realized I needed to get back to the States and do what I usually do, which is trying to write about how decision making works, and so I came back to the States, and it was 2004, and Bush was up for re-election, and I was sort of struck by the way that they had sort of deflected a lot of the attention from his policies to, and from, in fact, his war record to John Kerry and his war record, and I just thought, you know, I wonder what is going on here. Propaganda effort has been so spectacular on behalf of this man, and he really is such an unlikely person to have ever gotten to be president of the United States, the most powerful person in the world. And so I set out to try to find out if there was not a deeper story behind this improbable rise, and that sent me on a 5-year journey. I would say probably 3 years of which I really didn't find a whole lot, and then I suddenly fell down a rabbit's hole. And what I found in that rabbit's hole is what Family of Secrets is all about.
Well, and also we here at Cindy Sheehan Soapbox, we do focus a lot on the Bush administration and their crimes and the lead up to the Bush administration, because they certainly aren't the first administration that have committed these crimes. But a lot of people say that, oh, looking backwards is, you know, even our new president, Obama, says looking backwards is a waste of time and we should only look forward and we should only concentrate on the future. But I think, and I think you probably agree with me, that studying what went wrong is the only way to prevent it from happening again. So, you know, not only do we have this failed administration of the Bush regime and their crime family that has been prospering off of misery for generations in our nation and in the world, but we have a climate where reflection is not encouraged.
Well, that's right, Cindy. Not only is reflection not encouraged, but we just all seem to be in a rush to put anything unpleasant behind us and to seek either a pleasure in, you know, sort of escapism or in an unrealistically rosy sense of the present and immediate future. And we absolutely need to look back to understand what has happened to us and what we've been part of. It's not ancient history. I mean, this just happened. And, you know, most countries that go through traumas, and one doesn't want to overstate the comparisons, but, I mean, this country has been through trauma and a huge number of controversies and scandals. And other countries that went through those kind of things, whether it's South Korea or Chile or the Axis powers and so forth, all of these places have gone through a certain certain extent of self-reflection and you know, sort of these truth commissions or what have you. We've done nothing like that. And because we don't know what just happened, we don't even know what's just happening right now or what's going to be happening in the near future. We have very little understanding of how decision-making takes place and how power operates. And again, that's really, I think, what a Family of Secrets is about. It's about pervasive forces that are larger than the Bushes themselves that operate in the background and that continuously shape policy and really narrow the range of options for even a president who comes out of a kind of reformist framework such as Barack Obama.
Well, we, I think let's start from the most recent history and we'll work our way back. You talk about George Bush. And like you said, there was a total blackout on his past, on his really mediocre to poor performance in business, in you know, at school, in government, how he only became governor of Texas really through the machine of Karl Rove and some dirty tricks in Texas. But that things like that and his war record, like you said, were totally any mention of that was blacklisted from the media. And we found out that he went AWOL when he was in the Alabama Air National Guard. We found out about, you know, his his early days when he was just nothing but a party animal. And there's really, you know, there's nothing with that wrong with that. We all go through things like that, or our children go through things like that. But we don't become president of the United States of America either. And you and I met all around an incident that happened while he was governor. Can you talk to tell my listeners about that?
Sure. In 2004, while I was working on a series of articles, some of which appeared in The Nation magazine, I had the opportunity to persuade a man named Mickey Herskowitz, a Texas journalist and ghostwriter of biographies, to meet with me. Mickey had up to that point not talked to anyone. He had been working with George W. Bush in 1999 when Bush was a candidate for the presidency. Herskowitz and Bush were collaborating on a book that would become A Charge to Keep. It was a kind of a, you know, mini sort of biography light that was supposed to serve during the campaign. And Mickey had been removed from that project and had never spoken about why. What I learned from Mickey was that really it was quite extraordinary insight into Bush. One of the things he told me, Cindy, was that when they were working together on the book, and he explained to Bush that he'd wanted to talk about Bush's past and accomplishments and so on. Bush pushed him away from that and said, "Well, there really isn't anything to say. I really haven't done much." And I think it's extraordinary that Bush himself admitted that as he was on his way to being president. And then Herskowitz said, "The other option we have is to write about what you're going to do." And Bush again pushed that off and said, "Well, you'll have to talk to Karl Rove about that." He didn't seem to know. He felt he had accomplished nothing, and he didn't know what he was going to do. And that's really, I think, probably singular in the history of the American presidency. There was one thing, according to Herskowitz, that Bush had in his mind. He was sort of fixated on, and during these about 20 sessions they had together, Bush told him that one thing he really wanted to do was he had been. Sort of, it had been impressed upon him by Republican advisors over the years that the way you have a successful presidency is you win a war. And so he thought that his war was going to be Iraq. He said to Mickey Herskowitz, "If I have a chance, I'm going to invade Iraq. And I'm going to get accomplished all the things that I set out to do as president." And this was astonishing to me. I discovered this in late 2004, and I felt that since Herskowitz was not partisan, was friendly with the Bush family, and had a lot of credibility, that this story was enormously important. I could not get that story published. I talked to a lot of major news outlets, and they know me, and I've got a long track record as an investigative journalist. But they said, you know, we can't touch this story because of what happened to Dan Rather with those documents. And so in Family of Secrets, I not only tell my stories about Herskowitz, but I tell the Dan Rather story, and I am told that Family of Secrets represents the most definitive study ever of what actually happened with Bush and his military service, a 30-year cover-up. Which I believe was engineered in large part by his father and involving people at the highest levels of the government, because they knew that if it was discovered that this fellow had had gone AWOL from the military at a time when his father was the chairman of the Republican Party and a big supporter of the Vietnam War, the whole family would have gone down, basically.
Remind, well, before we get into this, and in the Herskowitz, you know, the things that came out, George Bush definitely said he didn't want to waste his political capital. He would invade Iraq, he would be successful, and then he would use that political capital to get other agenda items done. And when I testified at the Downing Street memo hearings on June 16th, 2005, we were only going back to July 21st of 2000. And two, I believe, was that the Downing Street meeting was in 2002.
But yeah, that's right.
In my testimony, I said, we have to go back. Let's go back to 1999 when George Bush said he wanted to be a war president and he would invade Iraq and that he would not waste his political capital. And in my testimony, I said in 1999, before my son even joined the military, George Bush, as governor of Texas, as candidate, he was only candidate, I believe, for the nomination of the Republican Party, said that he signed my son's death warrant. Back in 1999, in Texas, he did this. And it was amazing to me, like you said, that that wasn't like picked up by every mainstream media news outlet. But they just was said, oh, well, that's old news. That's old news. And that's the thing of not looking back, of not prosecuting people for torture and war that keeps us going into this torture and these wars for profit. And, you know, it's just amazing. And that's why we have to keep pressing and pressing and pressing to make sure that these things are exposed and understood so they won't reoccur. But in the Dan Rather story is super interesting. Can you remind my listeners what happened around that?
Sure. I mean, basically, a lot of journalists were looking at Bush's military service record, because here is somebody who voluntarily started a war with it, the tremendous consequences of which you more than most are aware, and yet he had hidden the fact that, not only had he managed to avoid a military service in Vietnam through connections, getting into a safe National Guard unit, but then 2 years before his period was up, he stopped flying. He was obligated to fly for 6 years. He only flew for four. And in Family of Secrets, I document exactly what happened there. He, by all indications, the sources that I've interviewed, he could not fly his plane. There was something that was debilitating him. There are various versions of that, whether it was just fear or it was substance abuse or something else was giving him problems. They needed him out of there. And I interview, he went off to Alabama, and the official version that was actually published by major news organizations in this country was that he left the Guard because he had a great opportunity to be a high-level campaign official in a U.S. Senate campaign in Alabama. And what I reveal, I interview the widow of the campaign manager, they'd been close friends of the Bush family, and she tells me that her husband got a call from George H.W. Bush, and he said, my son is in and out of trouble in Houston. I need to get him out of there. Take him and keep an eye on him down there in Alabama. And that what he actually did, far from the Washington Post, I think, described him as being assistant campaign manager with a lot of responsibility. He was somebody who showed up whenever he felt like, late in the afternoon, sometimes drunk, and he did things like putting bumper stickers on people's cars. I mean, it's just astonishing that how can it be, with all the scrutiny of things like Bill Clinton's sex life and so on, that we can't learn what exactly another president did during his wartime service when it really matters. And so Family of Secrets has a number of chapters where I not only go into great detail about all that, but I show how the Bush people really run more by the father in this sense than the son, with Karl Rove being really merely an operative on behalf of this larger enterprise. They decide that in order to keep the son in play, they've got to bury this thing, and they've got to attack the people who ask questions and distract the public. And so that, I believe, I have concluded, is what those memos, basically what happened was in September of 2004 on 60 Minutes 2, they had a report about Bush's National Guard service, and to back it up, they put some memos on the TV screen, and those memos appear to be from his commanding officer corroborating that there were some problems with Bush. Now, within seconds of those memos going up, bloggers started claiming they were forgeries and pointing to very obscure idiosyncrasies, purported idiosyncrasies. I researched all that. I, in fact, even had those memos around the same time 60 Minutes did. A lot of reporters had them. They believed them to be essentially correct because they reflected the other reporting we'd done. And yet, this caused this huge contretemps. Everybody jumped on CBS. Dan Rather was essentially forced out, and nobody wanted to look at Bush at all anymore. I now believe that that was a kind of a brilliant and very effective covert operation. And it's important, I think, for people to know that Karl Rove is not this sort of evil genius operating on his own. Back in 1973, he got his start. He'd been accused of dirty tricks as a college Republican.
Right.
And George H.W. Bush, the father of George W., was head of the Republican Party. And he said he was going to investigate the truth about this thing. He checks Rove out, gives him a clean bill of health, and then promptly hires him as his assistant at the height of Watergate. And so basically, Karl Rove is an operative not just for the son, but for the father and for the larger enterprise they represent. And Family of Secrets, readers will find that almost nothing in the book is familiar to them. I deliberately left out almost everything that's been written in other books. And what I focus on principally is how the Bush family have been operatives in a kind of a covert a structure of power about which we really understand very, very little, serving much wealthier families and interests, primarily around resource extraction, which remains the most important industry in the world, and their ties going back many, many decades to the Central Intelligence Agency, the founding of the Central Intelligence Agency, military contracting, and exclusive circles on Wall Street that permeate and that affect every presidency, irrespective of what party holds the White House.
Well, absolutely. And we just have a couple of minutes left before break, but I recently interviewed Dr. Justin Frank. He wrote the book Bush on the Couch.
Right.
And I asked him if he had seen Oliver Stone's movie W, and Justy had, and he basically said that it was a whitewash. Did you see W?
I did. I mean, I was disappointed primarily because, and I hope we can talk about this after the break, in Family of Secrets, I discover fascinating connections between the elder Bush and some seminal American events related to the Kennedy assassination and Watergate, really paradigm-altering information. And so I find Oliver Stone's earlier work important in his fearlessness in raising these things. And so I was extremely disappointed by his movie W. And I think he simply didn't know, he didn't have any deeper information. And I hope that he's had a chance to read my book. And I think after reading Family of Secrets, he'll have another movie to do.
Well, you know, I love Josh Brolin. He's a friend of mine, and he's a great actor, and he's a great left-wing activist. But yeah, I thought that the movie was very weak, W for weak. But that's why I asked you, because I did want to talk about President Kennedy's assassination. And like you said, Oliver Stone did make a very courageous movie, JFK, and we'll talk about that when we come back from not the movie, but what you found out about George H.W. Bush and the assassination of John F. Kennedy. You're listening to Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox. We're talking to journalist Russ Baker about his book, Family of Secrets. Please stay tuned, and we'll be right back after this break. This is Cindy Sheehan at CindySheehanSoapbox.com.
Hi, my name is Pam. I live in the Tenderloin District of San Francisco, and I have been a supporter of Cindy's since she announced she was going to run for Congress against Congresswoman Nancy Pelosi. I worked tirelessly on her campaign because I believe in Cindy, and I believe in the cause of peace and justice that she stands for. If you are listening to this show, then more than likely you support Cindy too. Please consider making a donation to keep Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox airing on the web. It is important for me to be able to continue to hear the truth. In a world where truth and courage are in such short supply, Cindy fills that void. Please go to www.CindySheehanSoapbox.com and click on the donate link. That's www.CindySheehanSoapbox.com.
A Nation Rocked to Sleep, written and read by Carly Sheehan. Have you ever heard the sound of a mother screaming for her son? The torrential rains of a mother's weeping will never be done. They say he's a hero. You should be glad that he's won. But have you ever heard the sound of a mother screaming for her son? Have you ever heard the sound of a father holding back his cries? He must be brave because his son died for another man's lies. The only grief he allows himself are long, deep sighs. Have you ever heard the sound of a father holding back his cries? Have you ever heard the sound of taps played at your brother's grave? They say he died so the flag will continue to wave. But I believe he died because they had oil to save. Have you ever heard the sound of taps played at your brother's grave? Have you ever heard the sound of a nation being rocked to sleep? The leaders want to keep you numb so the pain won't be so deep. But if we, the people, let them continue, another mother will weep. Have you ever heard the sound of a nation being rocked to sleep?
Find the cost of freedom buried in the ground. Mother Earth will swallow you, lay your body down. Find the cost of freedom buried in the ground. Mother Earth will swallow you, lay your body down.
Welcome back to CindySheehanSoapbox.com. We're continuing our conversation with journalist Russ Baker. Well, Russ, I found in some of the interviews I read that you've done about the book Family of Secrets that it's pretty amazing that George Herbert Walker Bush, he was the 41st president and father of idiot George Bush, the 43rd president, he doesn't remember where he was or what he was doing on November 22nd, 1963, the day President Kennedy was assassinated in Dallas. That's something that I find just incredibly hard to believe. I was only 6 years old when it happened, and I remember exactly where I was and what I was doing when I found out that President Kennedy had been shot. I was in my school's playground. I was in first grade. I was playing on the jungle gym, and my friend Karen Hill came out of the teacher's lounge and told us that all the teachers were crying because the president had been shot. George H.W. Bush actually said he didn't remember where he was on that day?
That's right. And then as a follow-up, he sort of said something about he thought he was somewhere in Texas. But the reason I even got on looking at that was I was looking, as I mentioned earlier, at the son, George W. Bush, and how he came to power. And the thing that really struck me was that we had been given a false sense that the son should be seen in isolation, that he, you know, a lot of the books talk about the rivalry between the father and the son. I finally concluded, my book has more than 500 interviews, I've got more than 1,000 footnotes, very heavily documented. I finally concluded from all of this research that this rift had been sort of exaggerated or manufactured, that in fact the father and the son were extremely close, and that although the son had a very different manner than the father and they did some things differently, that basically they were both working for the same construct, and the son, if anything, was trying to please and maybe outdo his father in serving these same interests. I also discovered the father's hand very covertly behind a lot of things involving the son, including, most importantly, the cover-up of the military service record. And so I began looking at the father, trying to understand more about him, and also because if the father had never been president, the son never would have been president. And I wondered, how would the father come to power? And so as I began studying the father's life, what I discovered essentially was that he'd lived a kind of a secret history. And I document in Family of Secrets the evidence suggesting that not only was he CIA director in 1976 for a year, something that was seen as strange at the time. People said, well, why is he getting that position? He doesn't have any qualifications or experience. But that, in fact, he had always been connected to the intelligence community for his entire adult life. That essentially, in George H.W. Bush, we are looking at a kind of a sort of a mirror image of Vladimir Putin, a lifelong intelligence officer who rises to the top. And so that's kind of an important sub-theme of Family of Secrets. But as I looked at and tried to reconstruct George H.W. Bush's real life, and I, knowing that he said he couldn't remember where he was November 22, 1963, I began looking at that. And what I found was so interesting and compelling and new that I have 4 chapters of Family of Secrets only on George H.W. Bush and the Kennedy assassination. And just to give a couple of morsels to your listeners, because we don't have time to go into it in any detail, there is, even though he says he can't remember where he was, there is one declassified memo from the day after the assassination, referring to the day after the assassination, with the FBI, J. Edgar Hoover, interacting with 2 intelligence officers about Cuban exiles and the Kennedy assassination. And one of those 2 intelligence officers is named in the memo as George Bush of the CIA. Mm-hmm. Now, he claimed it wasn't him, but as I documented Family of Secrets, it clearly was him. So at the same time he says he can't remember where he was working with Cuban exiles and somehow working for the CIA and involved with something relating to the Kennedy assassination. The second memo that I describe in the book is from the day of the assassination, and it's from 1:45 p.m., right around the time that they're announcing that President Kennedy is dead. It's George H.W. Bush, now private citizen oil man, as another representing himself differently, and he's making a clandestine phone call to the FBI office in Houston as a private citizen saying, oh, listen, I may have some information on who shot the president. Now, again, this is the same man who says he can't remember where he was. He obviously can't remember that he made that strange call. And I document that the phone call itself appears to have been a red herring. And if you read the facts that laid out, I think, very carefully in Family of Secrets, you come away with the conclusion that this phone call was a setup. He was doing this for some reason to establish in the records that at the time of the call he was outside of Dallas, mm-hmm. although admittedly not very far outside of Dallas, mm-hmm. And that he was supposedly trying to be helpful.
In Tyler, Texas, right?
Tyler, Texas. Right. Right. And I also document that in fact, the call itself was a red herring. He claimed not to know the man he was ratting out in the phone call, only had heard rumors. But in fact, he knew this man. This man did work for him in his headquarters. And he knew that the man was no threat at all. And in fact, the very moment he's calling to rat him out, I discovered and I interviewed Bush's then assistant, who was at the man's house at the time, giving him an alibi. And so these are very intriguing and deep things that are reminiscent. Anybody who's read a John le Carré novel, for example, or watched the British show MI5, they know that right. These kinds of layers and layers and layers of stories are very deliberate tradecraft of the most secretive and controversial and sensitive of operations. So the Kennedy thing's very, very important. And then the other thing I do is I go a little bit forward, and the next thing you see him is involved with the undoing of Richard Nixon. And
can
we
stay on the Kennedy assassination for a second?
Sure.
Because
sure.
I thought of a question, and you know, I have to admit to you and my listeners that I haven't had a chance to read your book because my son was in intensive care. He was very, very sick, and I usually, you know, when I interview somebody, I have read their things that they send me, so you know, I can be more informed. But I think this is an interesting question. I don't know if you cover it in your book, but I've been in Texas. I've spent a lot of time in Texas, as everybody knows. I camped out in front of George Bush's ranch in Crawford, Texas, which isn't that far from Dallas. It isn't that far from Tyler, Texas. It's not that far either from where President Lyndon Johnson lived. Was there any kind of connection between Lyndon Johnson and the Bushes all being involved in the same kind of Texas politics and Texas intrigue?
In fact, there is. And Cindy, one of the things I discovered in researching Family of Secrets is that many of the backstories, the relationship between the Bushes and Dwight Eisenhower, the Bushes and Richard Nixon, and the Bushes and Lyndon Johnson, had not made it into all of these books by these esteemed historians. I don't know how they missed these things, but the Bushes are sort of invisible in all of these accounts. And in fact, there was a very close relationship between George H.W. Bush and Lyndon Johnson. They had the same key financial backers. They were tied in with the same oil men. They supported the same policies in Vietnam. And also, I even have some stories in the book. I actually quote a lawyer who listened in on the phone when LBJ was calling his lawyers right at the moment that Kennedy was expiring. It's most astonishing. I'll leave that for your listeners to read in Family of Secrets. The most astonishing story told to me by a man who was a lawyer for the Republican Party and a respected and serious figure in Texas, stories that have never come out before. But these things are, yes, they're very, very deep, and they tell us that just saying somebody's a Democrat and somebody's a Republican doesn't even begin to get at the truth of how decisions are made.
Right, and I've never heard of a Johnson-Bush connection either until I just thought of that question. So that is super interesting and just really kind of creepy, too. Talk about creepy, you know, what about Skull and Bones? What kind of relevance do you think that has in this story?
I touch a little bit on Skull and Bones, but because so much has been mentioned about it elsewhere and written about it, again, I tried to, at 500 and some pages, you would think that I would need to fill it with fluff and with things that I just took from elsewhere, but really I didn't even need to do that. I will say this. What the Bushes really represent is the fact that in this country, since the very beginning of this country, even before the Declaration of Independence, there's always been a battle for control between those who believe in what we can call Jeffersonian democracy, a democracy of the people,
right,
and those who believe that only elites should rule.
Right.
And Skull and Bones and all of these outfits that these people belong to, and I do in Family of Secrets document their connections through a variety of these things. They're all designed to encourage people to stay in the system, to remain loyal to each other, to honor bonds of secrecy, and this is something. It's a very, very dangerous thing, and I know that Lincoln and a number of other presidents, FDR and so on, talked about the danger of having people in high positions of public office who have sort of made secret oaths to others. And so yes, those things are very, very important in creating a kind of a cohesion among those folks.
Well, we have about 10 minutes left, so I do want to talk about George H.W. Bush's, you know, influence and what had been bringing Richard Nixon down. But when I was reading, researching you and the book and reading reviews, there seems to be this total knee-jerk reaction to anybody who says anything bad about any of these ruling elite people. Like you said, you know, I fly through Houston International, or whatever they call it.
George Bush Intercontinental.
I call it George Bush Intergalactic Airport. And I fly through that a lot. And I just really hate walking by the statue of him with his jaunty coat, you know, flung over his shoulder. And I just think that, you know, he's getting old. I don't think he has that much time left on Earth. But as soon as one of our presidents dies, no matter what kind of a scoundrel he was, he becomes like, joins this pantheon of gods of former U.S. presidents. And, you know, that's just something that is a myth. They've all been scoundrels. It's like a rogues gallery of scoundrels, of people who have occupied the Oval Office. But tell us a little bit, and there was this knee-jerk reaction in the reviews of people saying, oh, you know, Russ Baker went way off base, his research was shoddy, he jumps to these wild conclusions without connecting the dots. Can you talk about that, and then tell us about the Nixon episode?
Sure. Well, first of all, the overall response to Family of Secrets has been extremely positive. You see on Amazon that average people, I would say 99% of them, think the book is phenomenal. It's also
because we all think the Bushes are criminals. It's just
elite. I'm talking about people who've actually read the book and compare it to other books. And
right. And
it's been, you know, the book and my work have been praised by people like Gore Vidal, speaking on Book TV. He said that he was flabbergasted by the book, and he told me that he thought it was one of the most important books he's seen in years. Bill Moyers, Roger Morris, Dan Rather, all kinds of very sophisticated people,
right,
say that they have learned a great deal of new things from Family of Secrets. So I'm not too concerned about that, but I will say this. The attacks that have come have been on the basis, one that ran in the Los Angeles Times basically said that because I attempted to learn new things about the Kennedy assassination, that made me basically a kook.
Mentally ill. If you don't believe the official story, what he's saying doesn't matter if it's you or me or anybody. If you don't believe the official story about Kennedy's assassination or what happened on 9/11, then you're mentally ill. That's what that person said.
That's essentially what he said.
Yeah.
And that's interesting because polls show that about 80% of the American people do not believe the story that Lee Harvey Oswald was the sole assassin or the assassin of Kennedy. Also, a House investigative committee concluded in the 1970s that, based on their research, that there was in fact some sort of conspiracy in Kennedy's death. So obviously this fellow doesn't know about that or doesn't care. But the thing is this: the establishment is always going to kind of circle the wagons.
Right.
You have to remember that even in the media, many people in the media are highly privileged. If you look at the people who tend to run the major magazines and TV news shows and things, most of them come from affluent backgrounds, and they went to, you know, exclusive Ivy League schools and what have you, and they know on what side their bread is buttered. And those who didn't, who came from more modest circumstances, and who now, you know, make these great fortunes as newscasters and so on, they also understand, and they tell me this privately, that there are just big subjects that they cannot tackle. It's just beyond the pale for them.
Right, and like I said, they belong to the robber class, just like the government and the military-industrial complex and Wall Street. It's all part of the robber class. But in the 5 minutes we have left, we aren't going to get a chance to talk about Prescott Bush, the granddaddy Bush, but tell us about Bush's connection to bringing the presidency of Richard Nixon down.
Well, this is another thing that astonished me. See, the Kennedy assassination stuff, I didn't really know much about the Kennedy assassination than anybody else. I'd never really been a buff or paid a lot of attention to it, but I had to begin looking at it because of what brought me to it in this book about the Bushes. Same thing with Watergate. Of course, I knew, you know, the general sense that Nixon was out of control and really quite a dangerous figure in that period. But as I began looking again at George H.W. Bush's path to power, I was struck by the fact that despite a lack of qualifications, Nixon was constantly promoting him to these very important positions, even while Nixon was firing everybody else around him. And so I was fascinated that even in 1968, when the elder Bush was just a freshman congressman, there was this big letter-writing campaign from all these major corporations pressuring Nixon to put him on his short list for vice president, mm-hmm. which he did. And then Nixon, in 1970, named him to be UN ambassador at the moment of great and sensitive international negotiations. He then makes him the head of the Republican Party in 1973 at the height of the Watergate scandal. So I said, why is he doing this? And what I discovered, and there's one chapter in Family of Secrets that's just about this, a secret backstory which ties Richard Nixon's beginnings in politics to the Bush family and the banking interests that they represented. Again, not time here to go into detail. The other thing I discover is that Nixon felt obligated to the Bush family, so he kept George H.W. Bush around, not realizing, perhaps, about Bush's own connections to the intelligence apparatus. And in Nixon's presidency, what I learned was that Nixon began trying to buck his masters and doing his own thing, right. The secret negotiations with Kissinger, many policies that today are considered very liberal in terms of the environment and labor and antitrust and what have you. And basically, Nixon began to anger these people, and they wanted him out. And I have three chapters in Family of Secrets, all new information about Watergate, suggesting very strongly that, in fact, what brought Nixon down was not his own doing, but a concerted effort by powerful forces associated with elements within the intelligence community tied to George H.W. Bush.
Was George H.W. Bush kind of like the J. Edgar Hoover of the CIA, or was it just a conspiracy in that community to bring Nixon down, or did they have stuff on Nixon that they threatened to expose?
It really was a classic conspiracy. And again, in Family of Secrets, I actually lay out the details before the Watergate break-in. And by the way, the Watergate break-in very clearly was deliberately botched. Everything that the burglars did, everything that E. Howard Hunt, who coordinated, had done, was designed to cause a trail right back to Nixon, and that's what it did. But before the Watergate burglary, there were other things that are not well known that I document in the book that seem to have the fingerprints of George H.W. Bush and associates of his in the CIA that were also intended to bring harm to Richard Nixon and to his reputation.
Now I have to go home and make a point of reading the book, and thank you for sending it to me. In the last couple minutes, is there something that you want my listeners to particularly know, and how can they get a hold of you? I know you have a website, and maybe you can remind me. I told my listeners what your website was when I introduced you, but maybe you can remind them.
Sure. First of all, I think the main message of Family of Secrets and what I am talking about as I move around the country is that it's not just that we need to read history, and particularly recent history, because it's interesting or because we care about that. It's that these the factors behind what happens do not go away. And we understand very, very little, and as a result, we have very little control over our own lives. We all want to go to political rallies and get excited about a candidate and cheer and then go off and do our other things. But we really have an obligation to try to understand how things really work. That's really what Family of Secrets is about. It's about the failures of democracy, and the goal is to try to get people to do something about it, not just to become dejected. And so I've got several things. Number one, a nonprofit called whowhatwhy.com. whowhatwhy.com. It is an investigative reporting website. We are trying to raise money from the public. People can go there and say give, $20 a month or something on their credit card to support us so we can continue to do this kind of journalism, because when you bring light and oxygen to the subject, you begin on the road to a recovery. The book itself, more information at familyofsecrets.com, can be bought online. It can also be found in, I would say, most bookstores. I'd be happy to hear from folks. They can go to the websites to get in contact if they have suggestions on stories we ought to do. And we see this as a movement, very much of a people's movement to get the truth out and to, you know, renew commitment to serious investigative journalism that can enlighten people and strengthen democracy.
Well, thank you for that, Russ. We know that investigative journalism is on life support in this country, so please go to Who, What, Why. That's right.
Yeah,
whowhatwhy.com and check that out and support that cause. And thank you for being on the show, Russ. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Cindy.
You're listening to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox. We'll be right back after this short break with my rant.
Hi, my name is Pam. I live in the Tenderloin District of San Francisco, and I have been a supporter of Cindy's since she announced she was going to run for Congress against Congresswoman Nancy Pelosi. I worked tirelessly on her campaign because I believe in Cindy, and I believe in the cause of peace and justice that she stands for. If you're listening to this show, then more than likely you support Cindy too. Please consider making a donation to keep Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox airing on the web. It is important for me to be able to continue to hear the truth. In a world where truth and courage are in such short supply, Cindy fills that void. Please go to www.cindysheehansoapbox.com and click on the donate link. That's www.cindysheehansoapbox.com.
Welcome back to Cindy Sheehan Soapbox here at CindySheehanSoapbox.com. I'm your host, Cindy Sheehan. I hope I said Cindy Sheehan enough in that sentence. Today's rant is called Peace Mom versus Torture Mom. On December 9th, 2007, in response to an article in the Washington Post of that day, my campaign sent out a press release demanding that Nancy Pelosi come clean about what she knew about torture and when she knew it. Not very many people paid much attention to the article in the WAPO that day, but even less heeded my campaign's request, especially the torture mama herself, Nancy Pelosi. Now, after almost 18 months, why would people suddenly be concerned with this? First of all, dastardly Dick Cheney and his traveling lascivious smirk has been appearing all over cable news openly admitting to being an authorizer of torture. Secondly, Republican Pete Hoekstra of the House requested, through the Freedom of Information Act, the CIA memos that showed prominent Democratic leaders were briefed on what the robber class politicians and conspiratorial media call enhanced interrogation techniques, or what Torquemada of Spanish Inquisition fame called torture. Nancy Pelosi is not only the torture mama, but she is the insistent impeachment off the table Speaker of the House that did everything in her power to ensure that George and Dick were not held accountable for their crimes. Why? Because in true gangster fashion, the Bush crime cabal brought the Democrats in on their mess. It's called robber class protectionism. From Wall Street to Pennsylvania Avenue to the rotten halls of Congress, the robber class will protect themselves and each other and make sure not one of them pays for his or her crimes. It's a sweet deal they have going on, murder and torture for profit. And the only reason the robber class media is exposing Pelosi's complicity is because they also need to make sure that no one, especially themselves as paid Pentagon shills, be held accountable for so-called mistakes or downright crimes. Now Obama and his Justice Department are working overtime to protect the previous torturers, and with each passing minute become the very things they claimed to be against. Why does anyone still buy into the robber class myth of the so-called two-party system, or that one party is any better than the other? It's one of the biggest hoaxes foisted on a gullible public hungering for integrity in politics when there is very little to be found. The torture mama won't be held accountable for her complicity in the crimes of the Bush regime, and with Obama at the destructive helm of our rickety ship of state, neither will Bush Co. I would say it was up to us to hold the crooks politically accountable by voting them out of office. But that is also a pipe dream reserved for an electorate with the courage and integrity to vote with courage and integrity, not out of fear or out of lesser of two evilism paradigms. Do I want Mr. Evil or Mr. Less Evil? Are there degrees of evil or just exploitation of our good intentions that have always paved the way for evil to reign unabated or unopposed? Whether you are a Democrat or a Republican, you support politicians who support torture. At what point does that blame trickle down on the people who insist and persist in supporting and voting for one of the robber class parties? That time's getting close, my friend. Our Ask Cindy question today comes from listener Liz Allen. Cindy, what was the vote you got against the shill of a Democrat, Pelosi? Did you ever notice when she was in the presence of George War Bush, she always had that sickening smile on her face, as if in the presence of the Pope? What's wrong with the folks in San Francisco? Don't they know she's working against them and for corporate America? I had high hopes that I would knock the torture mama out of the box, too. I'm born, raised, and lived in California all my life and have lived within an hour of San Francisco for the past 14 years. I believe that hype that San Francisco was radically liberal and thought that someone with a progressive platform and pure intentions like myself would beat a faux progressive corporatist or a snake in Democratic clothing like Pelosi. I came here to San Francisco after uprooting my life and began an earnest, intense, and real campaign against Pelosi in January of 2008. My campaign must have dozens of photos of Pelosi fawning over that war criminal Bush, and we distributed them as often as we could by email and by literature. This district voted overwhelmingly for an impeachment resolution for Bush and Cheney in 2006 and have again and again demonstrated their opposition to the occupations in the voting booth and on the streets. So why did I lose? First of all, this district cares more about political party affiliation than performance or platform. I actually had a constituent email me and tell me that he loved me, he loved my platform, he loved my work, he hated Pelosi, he didn't vote for Pelosi, but he didn't vote for me either because I wasn't a Democrat. That's infantile political ideology. Secondly, even though I had a strong showing of 16.4% and almost 48,000 votes, this is not a radically liberal district. It is persistently in denial about how political pragmatism kills and tortures innocent people, and being the second most expensive community to reside in the entire country, it has old and new wealth that find comfort and profit in preserving the status quo. I worked like a dog to beat her, and we raised almost $700,000 in the effort. But Pelosi raised three times as much. Anyone wanting to defeat her would need a campaign chest of at least $2.5 million, and I find that obscene. So saying all of the above, I would like to make an announcement here on Cindy Sheehan's soapbox. I had very little support here in San Francisco from what I would have thought was my natural base, the anti-war peace community. And although we had some staunch and committed supporters and volunteers, I don't feel we received nearly what our campaign deserved or the respect our struggle commanded. The robber class owns the elections and the media, not just here in San Francisco, but all over the country. After the election, CNN didn't even report my results, although I came in second. They reported Pelosi's and the Republicans' numbers, and I doubled the Republicans' totals. Recently, I ran into Congressman Keith Ellison from Minnesota in Madison, Wisconsin, and he urged me to move to Minnesota and run for Congress. I did not run against Pelosi to be in Congress. I ran to beat her. But I ran based on true progressive principle, and I can't see myself moving to Minnesota or anywhere else just to beat a Republican or a blue dog Democrat. No matter what the myths of Pelosi are, she is the bluest Democratic hound dog, and I mean no disrespect to hound dogs. I am announcing today on Cindy Sheehan's Soapbox that I will not run for the torture mama seat here in San Francisco in 2010. I'm still paying in many ways for running in 2008, and I'm not going to put myself through the stress, strain, and heartache of another campaign to nowhere. I will concentrate on overthrowing the robber class through a revolution of values and inspiring others to do the same. I'll do that through traveling around the country, holding teach-ins and rallies, and I will do that through Cindy Sheehan's soapbox. I would like to thank all of you who donated to my campaign and who voted for me, or who walked precincts or gathered signatures to put me on the ballot. I think we became a family that can't be broken up, no matter who's the candidate in 2010. I would also like to encourage a progressive Democrat to run against Pelosi in the primaries in 2010, and a Green, Independent, or Peace and Freedom candidate to run against her in the general. If your campaign is serious and, quote, in it to win it, unquote, you will have my backing, my support, and resources that I gathered in my last campaign. Your assignment this week, your soapbox action, is to help me spread true progressive principles all over the country and, yes, all over the world. Tell your friends and enemies about our show and forward the URL to them. I'd like to encourage you to go to Cindy Sheehan's soapbox.blogspot.com. I am going out on tour. I'm leaving June 4th. I'll be gone from San Francisco. I'll be doing my shows on the road. And if you go to Cindy Sheehan's soapbox.blogspot.com, there is a schedule of the cities I'm going to be in. If I'm coming to one near you, I hope you come out to meet me. Thank you for listening to the show today. I'd like to thank Russ Baker for being my guest today. I'd like to thank, as always, Scott Cuddy, my engineer, Rich Bowser, my webmaster, and especially you for listening. I'll talk to you next week.
I must make my witness. I don't have to tell you things are bad. Everybody knows things are bad. It's a depression. Everybody's out of work or scared of losing their job. Dollar buys a nickel's worth. Banks are going bust. Shopkeepers keep a gun under the counter. Punks are running wild in the street. There's nobody anywhere who seems to know what to do, and there's no end to it. We know. The air is unfit to breathe, and our food is unfit to eat. We sit watching our TVs while some local newscaster tells us that today we had 15 homicides and 63 violent crimes. As if that's the way it's supposed to be. We know things are bad, worse than bad. They're crazy. It's like everything everywhere is going crazy, so we don't go out anymore. We sit in the house, and slowly the world we're living in is getting smaller, and all we say is, please, at least leave us alone in our living rooms. Let me have my toaster and my TV and my steel-belted radios, and I won't say anything. Just leave us alone. Just leave us alone. Well, I'm not going to leave you alone. I want you to get mad. I don't want you to protest. I don't want you to ride. I don't want you to write to your congressman, because I wouldn't know what to tell you to write. I don't know what to do about the depression and the inflation and the Russians and the crime in the street. All I know is that first, you've got to get mad. You've got to say, I'm a human being. God damn it. My life has value.
Chairs right now. Go stick your head out and yell. I'm as mad as hell. I'm not going to take this anymore.
Just get up from your chairs.
They're yelling in Baton Rouge.